Our final plenary session is to be delivered by Dr. Nathan Finn, who serves as Associate Professor of Historical Theology at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. He received his PhD from Southern?
Southeastern.
Oh, I'm sorry. Forgive me. He was here for a while. I remember Leah, was his wife, was in Dr. Moore's office, and for some reason lodged back there, the belief that Southern produces all the great PhDs at this point in time in the United States was kind of...
They're serviceable.
Yeah, okay. my apologies to that. Nathan teaches with Keith Harper in the Church History Department at Southeastern. He is the author of a couple of books, one with Keith dealing with the issue of slavery, dealing with editing of documents that was part of the antebellum debate over slavery, and then more recently, the Help Designs Travelers, Robert Hall Sr., which it is occurring to me increasingly was probably the key book that galvanized William Carey. Because of my own predilection for this man, Andrew Fuller, I think thought that his Gospel Worthy of All Acceptation was probably the key influence on Carey, but I think it's probably more likely Robert Hall's book. And so if you have an opportunity to get that, you're tapping into something that was absolutely at the central heart of the modern missionary movement. Dr. Finn is going to present, though, something quite different from either of those areas that deal with 18th and 19th century Baptist life. He is going to come and speak to us about Baptist witness during the Vietnam War.
Well, I am delighted to be on the campus of Southern Seminary. Appreciate the hospitality here. I was here at one time, spent 2 years here earlier in the millennium, and they were 2 years that I was telling my colleague Keith Harper last night. They were formative in shaping who I am, sort of theologically and from a historical standpoint. So I'm very grateful to Southern Seminary and hope that one day they can aspire to the heights of Southeastern Seminary. It has been called America's Longest War and the War Nobody Won. Despite sometimes acrimonious debates in the last decade over the War on Terror, the Vietnam War remains arguably the most divisive American military campaign since the Civil War. Vietnam both coincided with and contributed to a time of significant cultural upheaval, marked by all kinds of things: political assassinations, racial violence, student protests, presidential scandal, and of course the proliferation of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Between 1963 and 1975, the baby boomers came of age, resulting in heated and frequently generationally charged debates that occurred in living rooms, on college campuses, at political conventions, and at denominational meetings. Many of these localized conflicts centered upon the controversial war in Vietnam. The Indochinese Peninsula seemed to many to be an unusual place to commit American military personnel. Nevertheless, the Kennedy administration viewed it as strategic real estate during some of the most heated days of the Cold War. French Indochina, comprised of present-day Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, had been occupied by the French since 1887. From 1946 to 1954, the communist-led Viet Minh engaged in a war of independence against the French. When the communist revolutionaries defeated French forces in 1954, the negotiated peace, which was called the Geneva Accords, temporarily partitioned Vietnam, or at least intended to temporarily partition Vietnam, into northern and southern halves along the 17th parallel. Though free elections were mandated, they were never held. and the region became permanently divided into the Communist Democratic Republic of Vietnam in the north and the democratic, in the sense of politically democratic, state of Vietnam in the south. During the First Indochina War, that battle for independence, the Eisenhower administration committed significant American funds to aiding French efforts against the Viet Minh. Eisenhower hoped to prevent communists from establishing a beachhead on the Indochinese peninsula. Securing a democratic Vietnam was central to what was then called containment, the foreign policy doctrine that America had applied to communist states since the end of the World War, the Second World War. You think of it this way, it's just keeping global communism under control, containing them. Like Eisenhower, President Kennedy viewed a free and democratic Vietnam as crucial to halting the advance of global communism. After Kennedy's assassination in 1963, President Lyndon Johnson adopted a policy of escalation that included deploying ground forces to South Vietnam and conducting strategic aerial bombing campaigns inside North Vietnam. Though Congress never formally declared war on North Vietnam, over 58,000 American troops died in combat, most of them between 1965 and 1973. Now, like Americans in general, Baptists in the United States divided over the Vietnam War. And if we've learned anything else the last couple of days, it's that Baptists divide over all these wars, right? Lots of opinions. Many Baptists were generally sympathetic to American policy in Vietnam. For example, the Southern Baptist Convention mostly supported the war, at least in terms of its public denominational statements. Though he acknowledges a minority of anti-war dissenters in the SBC, historian David Setjay argues, quote, "The Southern Baptist Convention proclaimed a conservative point of view that both reflected the typical anti-communist rhetoric of American society and also emerged from actual Baptist experiences within communist nations. Often articulating a generic fear of communism as evil and atheist, SBC leaders and members buttressed this anxiety with proof of communist oppression obtained from missionaries and fellow believers inside communist countries." Setjay claims SBC leadership sided with politically conservative Americans in promoting a broadly pro-war platform within the convention. Though other scholars argue for a greater range of opinions within the SBC, most agree that Southern Baptists in general supported America's Vietnam policy more than any other major denomination. And we were at least nervous about those who voiced public opposition to the war. Other theologically conservative Baptists, such as the American Baptist Association and many independent fundamentalist Baptists, also tended to support American military involvement in Southeast Asia. So those Baptist groups that tend to be theologically conservative tend to be mostly pro-Vietnam. Some Baptist groups mostly oppose the war. Both the American Baptist Convention and the Progressive National Baptist Convention embraced a mostly anti-war posture in their public pronouncements about the conflict. These two denominations, along with some professors and students in the SBC, were of the opinion that it was the duty and right of the church to voice prophetic concern over Vietnam. If most Southern Baptists reflected the position of American conservatives in general, the ABC, the PNBC, and anti-war dissenters in the SBC reflected broader trends among the so-called New Left, a movement which made opposition to Vietnam a central plank in their cultural agenda. Their position also echoed that of other mainline Protestants, including most of the denominations active in the National Council of Churches. Of course, there were pro-war minorities among these groups, just like there was an anti-war minority in the SBC, but we're talking about generalizations. Now, my paper is not going to attempt any sort of comprehensive assessment of Baptists in Vietnam. That deserves a dissertation-length treatment, perhaps by an intrepid PhD student at Southern Seminary, since you guys are producing the best, right? My aspirations for this paper are much more modest. I'm going to assume a diverse range of responses among Baptists, and frankly, we should expect nothing less, as we've already seen, from a tradition that values liberty of conscience and local church autonomy. I've divided my paper into two sections. In the first section, I'll provide an overview of how Southern Baptists, Progressive National Baptists, and American Baptists responded to the war itself. In the second section, I'll highlight how Southern Baptists in particular responded to three controversial themes or events related to the Vietnam War. Between these two sections, we'll get a glimpse of Baptist responses to Vietnam at both the macro and micro levels. And so we're going to move from the big picture to episodic type things. So part one, I'm calling Baptist Hawks and Baptist Doves. In early August 1964, two American naval vessels were allegedly attacked by North Vietnamese torpedo boats while conducting intelligence missions in the Gulf of Tonkin. Though subsequent studies argued that at least one of the attacks never happened, that, by the way, has been substantiated just in the last decade, on August 7th, Congress passed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. The resolution authorized President Johnson to conduct military operations in Southeast Asia without a formal declaration of war. In March 1965, Johnson sent 3,500 Marines to South Vietnam. By the end of the year, over 200,000 Marines had been deployed to the region. Their mission was originally to defend the South Vietnamese population against the North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong. The Viet Cong was a pro-communist fifth column within South Vietnam that conducted guerrilla campaigns below the 17th parallel. So those are the folks in the South who are allied with the North. Scholars agree that most Southern Baptists were in favor of the escalation of military forces in Southeast Asia. According to Mitchell Hall, Southern Baptists were, quote, the most ardent supporters of military escalation in Vietnam, along with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, which was another theologically and culturally conservative denomination. For example, one study found that SBC ministers in Southern California were 82% in favor of increasing American military efforts in Vietnam, while only 1% argued for the cessation of bombing missions in North Vietnam. This was considerably more pro-war than any other denomination, and even the general American public. 21% of Americans in general favored halting the American bombing campaign, so 1% versus 21%. I do think it's possible, however, that Southern Baptists in Southern California were more pro-war than their brethren in other states. Darren Dochuk has recently demonstrated that evangelicals in Southern California were significantly more politically conservative in the 1960s than evangelicals elsewhere in the country, in part because that region was at the economic epicenter of the post-World War II military boom. They were the area of the religious right before the South got into the religious right. Though Southern Baptists in general supported the war, a closer look paints a more nuanced picture. In an article on Southern Baptist responses to Vietnam, Kent Blevins, who used to teach ethics at this institution, studied denominational resolutions and Baptist state papers between 1965 and 1970. He argues for a subtle evolution in attitudes during the course of the conflict. In 1965, the SBC was characterized by what Blevins calls tacit approval of American involvement in Vietnam. Though there were, between 1966 and 1968, Southern Baptists remained committed to U.S. policy in Vietnam, though there were growing calls for an honorable and just peace in Indochina. That's the language they began to adopt. The years 1969 and 1970 marked a change in tone as a growing number of Southern Baptists expressed hesitation toward or even outright opposition to the war. Yet even during these more controversial years, an overwhelming majority of Southern Baptists remained generally favorable to the war effort. Gregory Tomlin and Terry Lindley have demonstrated that the annual meetings of the SBC consistently adopted a pro-war posture. Though there were always a minority of doves who pushed back against the convention's support of the Vietnam policy, the doves never succeeded in persuading the SBC to adopt an even moderately anti-war resolution. Most Southern Baptists supported the Johnson and Nixon administrations throughout the war's duration, and even at the height of the anti-war movement, the convention was only willing to call for as swift a peace as possible without conceding South Vietnam to the communists. While undoubtedly pro-war, Tomlin argues that most Southern Baptists were never uncritical hawks. They based their unwillingness to publicly criticize military actions in Southeast Asia on the historic Baptist commitment to the separation of church and state. Simply put, it wasn't the place of the church to concern herself with military strategy or to involve herself in the formal peacemaking process, so almost a spirituality of the church type mentality applied to the Vietnam War. Many Southern Baptists were especially concerned about any denominational position that could be construed as unsupportive of American soldiers in Southeast Asia. In the aftermath of the 1967 Miami Convention, some Baptists interpreted the decision of some decisions of the SBC that were made there as being disloyal to American military personnel. In Miami, the convention's Christian Life Commission had brought a report that some messengers had thought advocated ending the war in Vietnam. Kind of vague language, I think intentionally vague language, so some people interpreted it that way. Messengers amended the report to include a statement explicitly supporting American military involvement until an honorable and just peace is secured. Following that report, Senator Mark Hatfield, an anti-war American Baptist layman from Oregon, delivered what many interpreted as a dovish address. Both the hawkish amendment and the dovish speech were both applauded by the convention, which seemed contradictory to many observers. At least two individuals wrote letters to then-SBC President Franklin Pascal, expressing concerns that the Miami Convention had not appropriately supported American troops. Pascal assured them that the SBC was behind American soldiers and agreed that the media had given too much attention to those voicing anti-war sentiments. He was doing damage control. Among the most pro-war Southern Baptists were current and former Foreign Mission Board missionaries, especially those who had served in South Vietnam. Southern Baptist missionaries in that part of the world viewed communism as a satanic threat to the gospel and feared that if American forces withdrew from Indochina, it would cripple Baptist witness in that region. Some missionaries even expressed pro-war positions in unlikely places. For example, in a sermon preached at Crescent Hill Baptist Church in Louisville, Kentucky, former FMB missionary Fred Linkenhoker gave a very positive portrayal of U.S. military personnel in Vietnam. He noted that American soldiers were rebuilding villages, helping place orphans and families, and in some cases even finding opportunities to share their faith with the Vietnamese people. Crescent Hill's pastor, John Claypool, was a leading convention progressive who was considerably less sanguine about America's Vietnam policy. So kind of unusual, you've got this pro-war missionary preaching there. Undoubtedly, the most famous Southern Baptist during the Vietnam era was Evangelist Billy Graham, at the time a member of the First Baptist Church of Dallas, Texas. As a committed anti-communist, Graham strongly favored American involvement in Vietnam, and he vocally supported Presidents Johnson and Lyndon in their prosecution of the war. Graham criticized anti-war protesters and other dovish activists, including his erstwhile friend Martin Luther King Jr. At President Johnson's request, Graham traveled to South Vietnam during two different Christmas holidays to encourage American troops. During the Nixon administration, Graham continued to support the war, somewhat generally in his public statements, but much more specifically in his private correspondence with the president. In fact, Graham only backed off of his support of Vietnam in the aftermath of the Watergate scandal, an event that chastened Graham's desire to cultivate close personal relationships with powerful politicians. Despite widespread support for Vietnam, some Southern Baptists dissented from the majority view and expressed hesitancy and even outright opposition to the war. This was especially true of faculty members in denominational colleges and seminaries. As a general rule, their opposition became more strident as the conflict dragged on. In a 1966 article in the Baptist Program, New Orleans Seminary theologian William Garman urged Southern Baptists to finance a Center for the Study of World Peace. The proposed center would bring together leading scholars to discuss peace, produce literature promoting peace, and host conferences and symposia for both clergy and laypersons. Garman also suggested Southern Baptists establish a peace library, possibly with extensions at the six seminaries, and to fund endowed chairs in peace studies at each of the six seminaries. Garman's New Orleans colleague, theologian Robert Soileau, summarized biblical teachings on war and peace for a 1967 article in The Baptist Student. That's going to be a periodical that's going to be mentioned over and over again. It was the newsletter of Baptist Student Union. Though Soileau surveyed both topics, he contended that Christian peacemaking efforts are superior to Christian participation in war. He apparently didn't consider warfare a legitimate form of peacemaking. Other scholars were less circumspect in their anti-war sentiments. Southern Baptist minister, novelist, and social activist Will Campbell served as the director of the Committee of Southern Churchmen. The organization was devoted to promoting neo-Orthodox theology and progressive social ethics among Christians in the South, particularly through a journal they published titled Catalogete, Be Reconciled. Campbell and his fellow contributors, including Southern Baptist college professors such as Jim Holloway of Berea College, Joseph Hendricks of Mercer University, and McLeod Bryan of Wake Forest, used the pages of Catalogete to make a biblical case for progressive ideas, especially racial equality and opposition to Vietnam. In 1969, theologian and pacifist James McClendon was terminated from San Francisco University after organizing a group of professors to draft a letter to President Johnson arguing for withdrawal from Vietnam. McClendon had been similarly dismissed from the faculty of Golden Gate Seminary 3 years earlier for encouraging civil rights activism among the students. In a 1968 article in the Maryland Baptist, Southern Seminary ethicist Henley Barnett argued that America should withdraw from Vietnam. He claimed he wasn't an absolute pacifist, but argued, quote, "The time has passed due for the United States to admit that she has made a mistake by sending troops to Vietnam and withdraw them." Barnett's article appeared alongside a pro-Vietnam piece by Western Recorder editor C.R. Daly. Barnett's occupation and family provided him with a unique vantage point on the war. He was an ethicist who had long been involved in peacemaking initiatives, but he was also the father of two sons. One was a fighter pilot flying missions over North Vietnam. The other was a draft resister taking refuge in Sweden. Barnett claimed to support both sons' decisions, citing the historic Baptist emphasis on liberty of conscience. In a 1969 article written for the Arkansas Baptist titled Christian Conscience and the War in Vietnam, Southern Seminary New Testament professor Frank Stagg argued that the undeclared war in Southeast Asia was the immoral product of the American military-industrial complex, and that America should repent of her involvement in Vietnam and halt the war as quickly as possible. The weekend after that article was published, Stagg expanded his thoughts into a sermon that he preached at Crescent Hill Baptist Church, at that time arguably the most popular church in Louisville among Southern Seminary faculty and students. I hear that might have changed. As I hinted earlier, Crescent Hill's pastor, John Claypool, was publicly opposed to the Vietnam War. Midwestern Seminary's religious education professor, Clifford Engel, wrote a strongly anti-war position paper in 1971. Citing reasons both spiritual and political, Engel claimed he could no longer in good conscience support the Vietnam War. In particular, he bemoaned what he understood to be America's loss of respect among other nations, particularly in Europe. Engel also outlined 8 steps for restoring American credibility, including withdrawing from Vietnam, scaling back the military, ending the draft, publicly repenting before the United Nations, and adding an emphasis on peace studies to every Southern Baptist Seminary's curricula. Reflecting wider cultural trends, many Southern Baptist students vocally opposed the war. In a 1967 article in the Baptist Student, Richard Myers, at the time pastor of University Baptist Church in Charlottesville, Virginia, wrote on the dilemma that the war was raising for Baptist students. He argued that Baptist students were adopting many different views of the war, and he urged his readers to adopt their respective views with a clear Christian conscience, whatever they might be. But he also made explicit his own opposition to American involvement in Southeast Vietnam, and many students followed his lead. For example, in 1967, a Virginia Baptist named Richard McBride, at the time enrolled at Union Theological Seminary in New York, wrote an anti-war letter to the editor of the Religious Herald. McBride claimed that the Vietnam War was incompatible with Christian principles and argued for the de-escalation of the conflict. He refused to unequivocally condemn the Viet Cong. He said, "I cannot unequivocally condemn the Viet Cong." He also accused his fellow Virginia Baptists of exalting nationalism over the brotherhood of humanity and urged them to search their consciences and oppose the war. McBride's letter provoked, shall we say, harsh criticism for other from other Religious Herald readers. In fact, there were no positive letters to the editor about what he wrote. In a 1970 commencement address at Rice University, graduating senior Jeff Cox argued that most American college students opposed the Vietnam War, and they did so on moral grounds. This is significant for our purposes because Cox was president of Rice's Baptist Student Union, and he spent the summer of 1968 teaching English in Vietnam on a short-term missions appointment with the Foreign Mission Board. Several students at Belmont University vocally opposed the war between 1969 and 1972. There were at least two vigils held in opposition to the war, though these were quiet affairs that didn't disrupt campus activities. Some invited speakers to BSU events in Belmont were dovish in orientation, including at least one unnamed speaker from the anti-war ecumenical organization, the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Baptist collegians in the Triangle region of North Carolina were especially anti-war. That's where I'm from. This area includes Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill, and it's home to several major universities and some of the most socially and theologically progressive churches in the SBC during the 1960s and 1970s. One of these churches was Pullen Memorial Baptist Church in Raleigh, which was led at the time by W.W. Finlater, arguably the most vocally anti-war pastor in the entire Southern Baptist Convention. It's perhaps because of the influence of these progressive churches, the BSUs, the Baptist Student Unions at Duke, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and NC State University openly advocated left-wing social positions. For this reason, the state's BSU had been the source of controversy among North Carolina Baptists since the mid-1950s. It had been going on for a decade by the time Vietnam begins. Baptist Students Concerned was an organization founded by BSU students in the Triangle in 1968. According to the Biblical Recorder, 16 North Carolinians participated in the efforts of Baptist Students Concerned to dialogue about race relations in the Vietnam War with messengers to the 1968 Houston Convention. Their results were mixed. Some messengers encouraged the collegians, normally privately, while other messengers urged them to focus on evangelism rather than social matters, often publicly. Christian Life Commission President Foy Valentine organized a panel discussion with Baptist Students Concerned. Numerous Baptist journalists covered the event, including Baptist Press Director W.C. Fields, not that W.C. Fields. During the discussion, which was attended by about 250 pastors and other leaders, students Ronald Joyner and Terry Nichols argued that many Baptist collegians believed the Vietnam War was fundamentally unjust and immoral. Baptist Students Concerned also attended the 1969 and 1970 conventions, and though the group didn't draw as much press coverage in those two later years, some messengers were convinced they were a liberal and perhaps even communist-inspired organization, a communist fifth column in the SBC. Throughout the war, the Christian Life Commission attempted to navigate the differing opinions within the convention while promoting a generally anti-war policy. CLC staffer Bill Dial took the lead in this. He authored a moderately anti-war press release in 1966 titled "The Silent Shriek of Baptists on Vietnam." Dial called for Southern Baptists to be more vocal in advocating peace in Vietnam, especially in light of the ever-rising body counts in that war-torn country. An undated internal memo written by Dial in either 1967 or 1968 listed several possible Vietnam-related actions that the CLC could take at the 1968 SBC annual meeting. All of them were meant to promote a swift, just, and peaceful solution to the war. Suggestions included possible resolutions, prospective speakers, potential CLC conferences, and partnering with the seminaries to set up faculty-student dialogues on the topic Christian Perspectives on War. We know they opted for the first option, which was resolutions. In contrast to Southern Baptists, American Baptists and Progressive National Baptists were virtually uniform in their opposition to the Vietnam War. In fact, the Progressive National Baptist Convention was one of the first American denominations to go on record officially opposing the conflict. In addition to formal denominational pronouncements, key leaders in the PNBC agitated against Vietnam regularly. One such leader was civil rights activist Gardner Taylor, the longtime pastor of the Concord Baptist Church in Brooklyn and one of the founders of the PNBC. In his final presidential address before the convention in 1968, Taylor called for a racially integrated American society and an end to the Vietnam War. William A. Jones, also a Brooklyn pastor, was another PNBC leader who was opposed to the war. In October 1965, Jones was one of the speakers at a press conference held by an ecumenical group of Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish clergy. The ministers had signed a declaration defending the right of Americans to publicly protest the government's policy in Vietnam. This declaration helped inspire the creation of a group called Clergy and Laity Concerned About Vietnam, or CALCAV, a progressive organization formed in January 1966 that was affiliated with the National Council of Churches. In his 1979 book, God in the Ghetto, Jones argued that militarism was inextricably linked to racism. He noted that President Johnson had declared war on poverty as part of his Great Society, while America had never formally declared war on Vietnam. Nevertheless, America spent $2 billion annually on the war on poverty and $3 billion on the undeclared conflict in Southeast Asia. By far, the most significant PNBC critic of the Vietnam War was Martin Luther King Jr. At the outset of the war, King had been only moderately opposed to the conflict. Though he was calling for a negotiated peace settlement as early as 1965, he initially refused to stage anti-Vietnam rallies along the lines of his marches to Washington, D.C. and Selma, Alabama. It's likely that King refused to take a firm stand against Vietnam because the board of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, though willing to let King express his personal opinions on the war, they were urging him not to take the focus off of securing full civil rights for black Americans. They said, this is our priority. Don't get sidetracked by Vietnam. But King was growing increasingly agitated by the war because he feared it was poisoning the popular atmosphere and, this is crucial, absorbing funds that he had hoped would go towards domestic reform. Around the same time, King's views on war and peace were in transition. From the beginning, he had advocated nonviolent resistance in his desegregation campaigns, and that's what he's famous for. But early on, he didn't make a wider application of that principle to international affairs. That began to change when he received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964. King viewed this honor as a commission to become a global peace advocate. He even flirted with the idea that it was a commission from God to become a global peace advocate. He moved increasingly towards a more consistently pacifist position, understanding peace as a matter of basic social justice. And by 1966, King was advocating total withdrawal from the Vietnam War, despite the concerns and sometimes protests of other black religious leaders at the time. On April 4, 1967, King gave a speech titled Beyond Vietnam at New York City's Riverside Church. The occasion for the speech was an anti-war rally sponsored by CALCAV, though the event itself was actually suggested by King, and it was intended to be a national platform where he could come out publicly against Vietnam. Other speakers included Rabbi Abraham Heschel and Amherst College historian Henry Steele Commager. In his Riverside speech, King called for unilateral withdrawal from the Vietnam War. He claimed the time had come for America to, quote, move past indecision to action. We must find new ways to speak for peace in Vietnam and justice throughout the developing world, a world that borders on our doors. If we do not act, we shall surely be dragged down the long, dark, and shameful corridors of time reserved for those who possess power without compassion, might without morality, and strength without sight. King subsequently became co-chair of CALCAV. Like the PNBC, the American Baptist Convention frequently and unambiguously adopted an officially anti-war posture. As early as 1965, American Baptists passed a resolution calling for a ceasefire. Later resolutions followed on an annual basis. In protest against the Dow Chemical Company, which produced napalm, the ABC divested their stock holdings of thousands of shares of Dow stock in 1967. At the 1971 ABC annual meeting, the convention elected anti-war protester and ecumenical leader Ruth Rolfs of Seattle as their president. Anti-war speakers on the program that year included future Senator John Kerry, then the spokesman for Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and Reverend Jesse Jackson, an ordained minister in the PNBC and a leader in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Several American Baptist pastors and denominational employees were also involved in anti-war ad hoc committees that were sponsored by the National Council of Churches. American Baptist scholars periodically spoke out against the war, and there's all kinds of examples, so I'm just going to give you two to illustrate this. In the March 1966 issue of the journal Christianity in Crisis, the Board of Editors published a short statement titled, "We Protest the National Policy in Vietnam." In the mind of these mainline theologians, American involvement in Vietnam was unjust, ill-conceived, and counterproductive. Among the authors of the statement was Harvey Cox, an American Baptist theologian teaching on the faculty of Harvard Divinity School. In 1968, Prentice Pemberton, an ethicist at Colgate-Rochester Divinity School, argued in an article published in the Christian Century that Vietnam had become a test of Americans' spiritual integrity. Morally mature Christians understood that anti-poverty initiatives at home were being underfunded due to anti-communist initiatives in Vietnam. Because it was an election year, Pemberton urged anti-war Americans to take over the Republican and Democratic conventions that were scheduled to meet later that year. Got a little bit of the political radical in him. Because of their shared convictions, anti-war Baptists periodically collaborated. For example, in 1942, Martin England, a former American Baptist missionary to Burma, and former Southern Seminary New Testament professor Clarence Jordan founded Koinonia Farm in southwest Georgia. Koinonia was an intentionally racially integrated community, and that caused no small amount of trouble in the Deep South during the mid-20th century. England used his position with the American Baptist Convention's Ministers and Missionaries Benefit Board, their version of the Southern Baptist Annuity Board, to provide aid to Baptist civil rights activists such as Martin Luther King Jr. But England, Jordan, and King were not only involved in anti-segregation initiatives, they were also committed pacifists and members of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, probably the leading religious pacifist organization in the country. These men and other religious progressives, such as Finn Later and Carlisle Marney, were part of a growing interdenominational cadre of Baptist pacifists who argued that war in principle was incompatible with biblical Christianity. So that brings us to part two, episodic Baptist responses to the Vietnam War. We've seen the generalization. Southern Baptists are mostly for it, with some variations in between. American Baptists and Progressive National Baptists are mostly against it. Well, like all major events in history, the Vietnam War was the sum of numerous smaller events, many of which provoked reactions from Baptists. So in the second part of this paper, I want to highlight three controversial episodes from the Vietnam War and point to various Southern Baptist responses. We'll look at the National Moratorium in 1969, the trial of Lieutenant William Calley in 1970, and the ongoing debates over conscientious objection, draft resistance, and granting amnesty to those who dodged the draft. So episode one, the National Moratorium. A national moratorium against the Vietnam War was staged at venues across the United States on October 15, 1969. The event was organized by Sam Brown, who was a Harvard Divinity School student, a former staffer for anti-war Senator Eugene McCarthy's failed presidential bid, and significantly a graduate of the American Baptist-related university, University of the Redlands in California. For anti-war activists, the time seemed ripe for peace. In January 1968, the Tet Offensive had soured many Americans toward the war. In 1969, Americans learned that an army company had massacred women and children in the South Vietnamese village of My Lai in March of the previous year. President Nixon had campaigned with the promise that he had a secret plan for ending the war, but by 1969, he implemented a gradual process he called Vietnamization, which included the training of South Vietnamese military forces and the gradual withdrawal of American troops from the region, with no clear timetable early on. Several congressmen, including Senator Hatfield, proposed bills calling for an end to the war, though none had yet passed either House of Congress. The idea of a peaceful and respectful national moratorium gained the wide support of liberal religious leaders, university leaders, students, and even some politicians. For the most part, Southern Baptist collegians, seminarians, and professors ignored the moratorium. Most of the 54 SBC-related colleges didn't observe the moratorium in a formal way, but some did. According to Baptist Press, generally, the larger Baptist schools on the eastern seaboard staged moratorium activities that were vocally in opposition to the war, including schools such as University of Richmond in Virginia, Wake Forest, Meredith, and Mars Hill Colleges in North Carolina, Stetson University in Florida, and Furman University in South Carolina. At many schools, the moratorium was observed by only a handful of students. For example, at Belmont University, a small group of BSU students held a vigil against the war. But Foy Valentine of the Christian Life Commission visited the campus and met with those students. The implication was he encouraged them, though he certainly didn't give any public indication to that. Two of the six SBC seminaries formally observed the moratorium. According to Baptist Press, at Southern Seminary, about 300 students and several faculty members declared public opposition to the war, wearing black armbands. Alumni chapel at the seminary was packed for a showing of a film about the war, and discussion afterward lasted so long that at least eight professors dismissed their classes. At Golden Gate Seminary, about a third of their 350 students attended a rally where ethicist Arthur Enscoe spoke on the proper Christian attitude toward the war. Southeastern Seminary didn't officially participate in the moratorium, but four students and two faculty members from the school marched in a community-wide observance in downtown Raleigh, though the newspaper report was quick to say that when people asked, they said they were just some students from Southeastern Seminary and some faculty. They did not have permission from the school to do it. In a speech delivered at Trinity Church in New York City the day following the moratorium, former Johnson administration staffer and Southwestern Seminary graduate Bill Moyers reflected on the state of the nation at the time. Moyers lamented America's loss of what he called rectitude in international affairs, and he regretted that a generation of young people had come of age during a, quote, almost unprecedented period of national disillusionment and self-excoriation. He argued America's national self-esteem, in fact, is the major domestic casualty of this war. And he closed on a somber but hopeful note. We seem almost at the point of waking from the long, feverish night of the war with its dreams of violence and despair. And when the awakening comes, if it doesn't come too late, perhaps then we will begin to understand how near to moral rot we strayed and how near to destruction it brought us. Moyer's comments reflected how many religious progressives felt about the war, including anti-war Southern Baptists. Episode 2, The Cali Affair. On March 16, 1968, the Charlie Company of the Army's 11th Infantry Brigade slaughtered as many as 500 unarmed citizens in the South Vietnamese village of My Lai. The soldiers, under the command of 2nd Lieutenant William Cali, erroneously believed that Viet Cong personnel were hiding in My Lai. Cali and his men massacred the village's inhabitants, even though they found no known enemy combatants. After an initial government cover-up, the American public learned of the My Lai massacre in 1969. Though all the participants were initially charged, only Cali stood trial. He was court-martialed and sentenced to life in prison, later changed to 3.5 years house arrest. The trial ignited a nationwide debate, in part because Cali claimed he had simply been following orders. Some believed Cali was a cold-blooded murderer. Others believed he was a hero. Following Cali's court-martial in 1970, Baptists weighed in on the debate for several months. Most of them were horrified by Cali's actions and the public response. Some used the Cali incident to criticize the American government. For example, Avery Lee, pastor of St. Charles Avenue Baptist Church in New Orleans, argued in an article in his church's newsletter that Cali's conviction was an indictment of the entire United States government from the commander-in-chief on down. In an editorial in the Western Recorder, editor C.R. Daly lamented the fact that Callie was considered a hero in the eyes of so many Americans. Daly thought it a shame that soldiers guilty of lesser crimes were in military prison, while Callie was simply under house arrest. Daly believed that, quote, all other members of the military system share Lieutenant Callie's guilt to varying extent. This goes from the U.S. President as Commander-in-Chief all the way down through the Pentagon, every general and other officer giving orders to the troops. Also, American society, including the one writing these words, must also confess its guilt in not finding long ago a way to settle conflicts apart from barbarism characteristic of pre-civilized man. Close quote. As evidenced in Daly's editorial, the events surrounding Callie's trial helped lead this one-time vocal supporter of the Vietnam War to soften his earlier support of America's war policy. An editorial in the Indiana Baptist took a similar position. The piece criticized Callie's supporters and critics for emotional responses to the young officer's trial. It also argued that the responses to the Callie controversy betrayed a national guilt complex, because most Americans had come to believe we were losing a war in which we probably should never engage to begin with. The editorial closed by hoping the Callie trial had pricked the nation's conscience and would hasten American withdrawal from Vietnam. Southern Baptists who wrote about My Lai and Callie were horrified by the incident and what it said about American culture. They were also convinced that the entire government shared some of the blame, though they fell short of insinuating deliberate malfeasance on the part of the White House or Army Chief of Staff William Westmoreland. And if we had more time, we would see that American Baptists and Progressive National Baptists were not quite so optimistic that there wasn't some grand conspiracy going on. Episode 3, Conscientious Objection and Draft Resistance. The 20th century witnessed considerable diversity in how Baptists approached questions of war and peace, normally depending upon world events at any given time. Because of their commitment to liberty of conscience, Southern Baptists had long recognized the rights of religiously motivated pacifists. Southern Baptists had officially affirmed the right of individuals to serve as conscientious objectors since 1940. Those who wished to receive this status simply needed to fill out a registration card to be kept on file with the SBC's executive committee. If necessary, the convention could then in turn intervene on behalf of the individual with the selective service system. During the Vietnam War, the SBC continued to affirm the right of individuals to conscientiously object, though not without controversy within sectors of the convention. Following the Tet Offensive in 1968, a growing number of Baptists began to advocate conscientious objection. In April of that year, Wayland University sociology professor Alban Wheeler argued in The Baptist Student that Christians sometimes have a responsibility to dissent from unjust social and political positions, even when those positions are popular with the wider American public. He claimed that the right to principled dissent is rooted in the Christian tradition and is intrinsic to American democracy. Later that year, Jay Kaufman, president of the BSU at Johns Hopkins University, wrote a defense of conscientious objection, also published in The Baptist Student. And Kaufman harshly criticized those who insisted it is the patriotic or Christian position to participate in the war. In his thinking, war objectors, draft dodgers, and even those who burned their draft cards were heroes and martyrs, and they ought to be honored for their principled stand. In November of 1969, the Baptist Student published an article that explained all the different ways a draft-eligible individual could avoid military service, both legal and illegal. The article explained all the various draft classifications, coached draftees on how to navigate the Selective Service System's bureaucracy, and included extensive information about the qualifications for conscientious objectors and the expectations placed upon them for some type of civilian service in aid of the American cause. The editors also reprinted the 1940 SBC resolution on conscientious objection. By all appearances, the editors of The Baptist Student were at least implicitly encouraging conscientious objection. It was just a barrage of articles year after year, not very many of them even neutral on the war. State conventions periodically debated conscientious objection and other related issues. For example, at the 1968 annual meeting of the Baptist State Convention of North Carolina, a Southeastern Seminary student named Terry Nichols proposed a resolution affirming conscientious objection. You may remember his name from earlier. Nichols was a recent graduate of NC State University and was the founder of Baptist Students Concerned the year before. Nichols had previously indicated his own religious objection to the war during that panel discussion that Foy Valentine hosted with Baptist Students Concerned during the previous summer's convention. After intense debate, Nichols' resolution was referred to the convention's Council on Christian Life and Public Affairs, their state version of the Christian Life Commission, which was report back the following year. In response to the Nichols resolution, the council published a brochure affirming conscientious objection in 1969, and that action was approved by messengers to the state convention's meeting. Sensing a possible opportunity, W.W. Finlater then stood up and proposed a resolution affirming the right to draft resistance, a far more controversial topic. Finlater's resolution was subsequently also referred to the Council on Christian Life and Public Affairs, where it was ignored. As Terry Lindley notes, quote, "While the messengers accepted the publication of a pamphlet on conscientious objection, they drew a hard and fast line at amnesty for draft dodgers." Controversy over conscientious objection spilled over at the 1972 SBC annual meeting in Philadelphia. A resolution was proposed that simply restated the convention's position on the topic, which had first been affirmed in 1940. The resolution ignited heated debate, with several messengers arguing that conscientious objection was an insult to American troops in Southeast Asia. One messenger argued that conscientious objection and the right to engage in war cannot both be right, since that would imply Scripture was contradictory in allowing for different opinions on the matter. The resolution ultimately failed, actually reversing the SBC's previous position endorsing the right of conscientious objection. They changed their mind. It's a resolution, it's not binding. So they're still doing it, but now they're on record saying it's not a good idea. It's likely the resolution failed because it followed on the heels of another unsuccessful resolution right before it, proposing that the SBC support amnesty for draft resistors. If conscientious objection was a hot discussion, the debate over amnesty was nuclear. An overwhelming majority of Southern Baptists were firmly opposed to granting amnesty to those who had burned their draft cards or fled to other countries to avoid service in Vietnam. But as Gregory Tomlin notes, the draft was perceived by a small but growing number of Southern Baptists as an enemy to liberty of conscience. This included many draft-age students, a handful of professors, and progressive pastors such as Finlater. The most notable scholar to argue for amnesty was Henley Barnett. In an article published in the Christian Century, Barnett argued for amnesty for all draft resistors, a group which you will remember included his son, though he claimed that had nothing to do with his position. He contended that amnesty honored the individual conscience and those who opposed the conflict, the conscience of those who opposed the conflict, and he hoped that amnesty would bring about national reconciliation in a nation divided over the late war. Though most Southern Baptists didn't share Barnett's view, ironically enough, it was a Southern Baptist layman, President Jimmy Carter, who granted amnesty to draft resistors on his first day in office in 1977. So since it was President Carter, I guess it wasn't a nuclear issue, it was a nuclear issue. In closing, it has been said that where two or three Baptists are gathered together, one finds at least a half dozen opinions. Though it is a tired cliche to be sure, this old saw proves true when it comes to the Vietnam War. Some Baptists, especially within the SBC and among other theologically conservative groups, supported the war effort, viewing it as strategic in America's Cold War against communism. Other Baptists voiced significant opposition to the conflict, including some denominations, such as the American Baptist Convention and the Progressive National Baptist Convention. Virtually all Baptists desired to see peace in Southeast Asia and elsewhere, though they disagreed over the best means to bring about that peace. In other words, when it came to Vietnam, Baptists were very much like Americans in general. One final observation about Southern Baptists in particular. During the Vietnam War, one's position on the conflict was something of a barometer for where he or she would shake out during the inerrancy controversy that engulfed the convention during the final two decades of the 20th century. Many of the progressives who dissented against the convention's mostly pro-war stance also opposed the resurgent conservatives who captured the denomination's key leadership positions in the 1980s and 1990s. The same conservative grassroots that supported American intervention in South Vietnam mobilized in support of inerrantist presidential candidates in the SBC a decade later. Similar trends were also evident in how both groups responded to the Reagan Revolution that captured the Republican Party and controlled the White House during the 1980s. When it came to Southern Baptists, response to America's longest war was a prelude to the various responses during the convention's longest war. Though in the case of the inerrancy controversy, this war proved to be a war that somebody actually won. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Notice you didn't mention T.B. Maston. Where did he shake out on all this?
T.B. Maston was what I would call softly opposed to the war. Maybe even a better phrase would be uncomfortable. Near the very end, which was at the end of his career, he began calling for it. But by that point, many people had called for it. We're talking about 1972. We're on the verge of pulling out. So during the heart of it, he was somebody expressing discomfort, but he stopped short of the position of people like Henley Barnett. Yeah.
So, go ahead. Yeah. Thanks very much. Did this then generate an enormous amount of holy war rhetoric around the announcement by SBC representatives? Was it all lines of, we must fight this apocalyptic war against communism?
I wouldn't say, yeah.
The domino theory?
Very much so. Very much so. Never explicitly holy war rhetoric, what I would call more civil religion rhetoric. And so America was engaged in a struggle to the death against godless communism, and this was a leading front in that struggle. And they couldn't understand why there were either many other anti-communist countries that didn't see this part of Asia as being so strategic in the battle as they saw. And so they couldn't understand why British evangelicals and Australian evangelicals and others didn't see things exactly the same way they did. So very much that way, but in sort of a muted civil religion form where they aren't explicitly using that language.
Yeah. Any trends on the treatment of returning soldiers between these disparate groups?
No, both groups in this case were pretty kind to how they treated returning soldiers. So just to use one example, Crescent Hill Baptist Church, with that one exception of the missionary sermon, had consistently had anti-Vietnam rhetoric in the pulpit. But they took the lead when troops came back in providing ministry to them and caring for them. And in fact, about 10 years after the war, they hosted a Reconciliation Sunday where they invited back a couple of former pastors who had been anti-war and several war veterans to be there, and they all prayed together and they hugged each other and this and that. And so that was the general trend, was to, in Southern Baptist circles at least, to move towards reconciliation and to try to put that past behind them. And some of that might be tied to the fact that within 5 years after the evacuation of the last few people in the embassy in Hanoi, you had the inerrancy controversy beginning. And so you had a shift to that and to the national political controversies over Reagan and the Democratic Party and things like that.
You mean Saigon?
Did I say Hanoi? I meant Saigon. Yes.
During the Civil War, obviously, you know, there was a trend toward lots of sermons in ASB among Southern Baptists about Civil War, typically for the Civil War. Was there the same phenomenon or similar phenomenon with regard to the Vietnam War, both for and against the war in pulpits?
The most I can give is hints to that, because there are many of those individuals who are still alive and so their papers have not yet been passed on and things like that. So there were some for sure, and most of what we have would be against the war. And that's because there were groups like the Christian Life Commission, people like John Claypool and others who in their papers were, it was known who was for it and who against it in general. And so if I was an anti-war pastor and you were an anti-war pastor, I was sending you a copy of my manuscript. And just the simple fact is not enough of those folks have died yet that they've left those papers in places so that we can see the full scope of what's there. But there are many things that are available, and the vast majority of it is anti-war. In fact, the couple of things I found that were pro-war were almost accidentally in a collection, that there wasn't a rhyme or reason for why it was in somebody's papers, whereas there was always a reason for why somebody had a folder of anti-war sermons. Yeah?
Kind of an anecdotal observation. You commented early on that the California pastors tended to be almost surprisingly hawkish.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
California,
yes.
There. I remember sitting down one day to talk to this fellow, and this is almost an exact quote that he said. He said, "Son, if it weren't for us Arkies and Okies, there wouldn't have been a California."
That's exactly right. That's exactly what I was getting ready to say, is if you look at Darren Dochuk's recent book, From Bible Belt to Sun Belt, it's Arkansas, Mississippi, and Oklahoma, and they move to Southern California to take jobs in the military industry, and there was an explosion of Southern Baptist Assembly of God and Nazarene churches in that area. And they were some of the first evangelicals to make the switch from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party, and they were doing it 20 years before it was happening on the national scale. Yeah.
Could you name some any exceptions you came across to the trend between anti-war cohort and which side they took on the conservative resurgence? So someone who was anti-war but conservative in the conservative resurgence, but someone who was pro-war.
Okay, sort of. There were many examples of people who were pro-war but anti the conservative side in the inerrancy controversy. To the best of what I have been able to find, everybody who was opposed to the war was uniformly opposed to the conservative resurgence. So not everybody who was hawkish was theologically progressive, but almost everybody who was dovish was theologically progressive. Well, we're talking about Southern Baptists.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, just in the SBC. Yes, absolutely. Hatfield would be an exception to that, but not in a Southern Baptist context. Yeah?
Was the National Baptist Convention pretty lined up with the Southern Baptist Convention?
You know, I wanted to talk about the National Baptist Convention, but they were so doggone vanilla about the thing. I mean, they got together every year and they said, boy, war is a terrible thing, and we need to raise up some more chaplains that we can send into the war. And they never would take a hard line one way or the other. The same thing you found, frankly, among some of the fundamentalist groups who just, you know, war is a bad thing and we need to pray for our boys who are over there. But there wasn't really any firm support or opposition as much as there was just an affirmation that it was a reality. So I was expecting National Baptist to perhaps be a little bit more like progressive National Baptist, and what I found is just like they were moderates on the race issue, they were moderates on the war issue, and they didn't fit neatly into either camp.
And they would never, ever say anything supportive of King.
Yeah.
So they could have been strongly anti-war, but there's no
way right. Well, I'll just say this. Almost everything that I found that was a reference to Vietnam and their minutes came from Joseph Jackson himself. And so he had a firm control sort of on that mechanism. And he doesn't say anything negative about Vietnam until like 1972. And by 1972, the Hawks were saying, boy, I'm glad we're getting out of there. So, I mean, it was, you know, kind of late to the party.
Yes. Let me ask you to be a little bit prophetic. In 20 years, if we have a conference like this and we're discussing the Iran war or the Afghanistan war, what would you guess we would be saying about Baptist attitudes to those conflicts?
Now, see, a New Testament professor would be the type of person who would ask a historian to be a prophet. Yeah, I... You know, I don't know, but what I can say that I can say anecdotally, and that's all it is, that I sense a little less resiliency among my students towards the war on terror than I sense among their parents among the war on terror. So I think it's at least possible. I mean, it's not to say that there's drastic differences, but there's definitely sort of the muscle memory is toward patriotism and support among one generation, and at least let's ask questions, if not opposition, among the younger generation. And so my suspicion is, even if you took a group of very conservative and patriotic Baptists, like Southern Baptists, if we were to talk about the war on terror in 20 years, you would find a variety of perspectives from I was completely against it the whole time, to I was completely for it the whole time, to I was okay with it in 2001, and by 2011, I was going, man, what are we doing over there? So I think you're going to find a spectrum. But don't stone me if I'm wrong. Thank you very much.
Thank you.